Mr. Ducote.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I want to respond to a couple things I heard from the questioning earlier, but I'd first like to recommend to this court how you should decide this particular case and why. And the state is asking that you affirm the judgment in this case and that you do so on the narrowest grounds. The reality borne out by this record confirms what the motion court found, and that's FED does not suffer from a permanent physical incapacity. And we've talked about what the definition of that is, and it requires more than the possibility of future incapacitation. The inmate must show at present he is forever unable to perform activities of basic daily living. Not that it is difficult, not that he needs some assistance, but that he cannot now or ever perform them. And what this record shows at most is that FED suffers from a permanent physical disability, a medical condition that causes him difficulty in doing some instrumental activities of daily living. But surely the legislature, by choosing the language that it did and imposing the burden of proof that it did, expected inmates to prove more than FED has here. Now, whether that's deemed to be a flaw in the certificate of eligibility, which is the way the appellate division looked at it, or more appropriately, the way the trial court looked at it was a flaw under subsection F1. Either way, FED failed to show by clear and convincing evidence that he suffers from a permanent physical incapacity. And for that reason, this court can affirm on that basis. Now, we don't necessarily agree with the appellate division that it has to be all activities of basic daily living in the sense that if an inmate can't perform six but can somehow perform a seventh, that they're not entitled to release. But I would agree with the trial court who put the number at three. And the reason why the trial court put the number at three was because the compassionate release statute cites the Medicaid statute. And the Medicaid statute requires an applicant to show that they can't perform three activities. So I would submit it as an absurd result to let someone out under the compassionate release statute and then them being statutorily ineligible to receive Medicaid benefits. So I think setting that number at three ensures that properly released inmates get the kind of relief that the legislature intended them to. And I think a number greater than one or maybe even two is probably appropriate in this case, given the heavy burden that's put on the inmate and given the truly extraordinary relief he gets if he prevails. Now, there was some discussion earlier about the trial court and do they have the authority to review the medical finding. Now, I think embedded in subsection F1, and that's what the trial court found, was that the inmate has to be unable to perform activities of basic daily living. And so the trial court was well within its authority to hear testimony on that issue, which was proffered by the defense, and to look at the documents considered by the Department of Corrections in issuing the certificate. I think if you look at page 111 of the defendant's appellate division appendix, which is from the report from the Criminal Disposition and Sentencing Commission, they talk about one of the things the trial court should be doing is making sure that that medical diagnosis is proper, meaning it's consistent with the statute. The trial court makes the ultimate decision whether the statutory criteria are met, and obviously can take a holistic approach to the evidence to make sure that that is the case. We also talked about the purpose of the law, and the purpose of the law is certainly to have more inmates be eligible and, of course, to save some money. On the latter, we know that the fiscal estimate from the legislature was this was a modest savings at best. But to your point, Justice Albin, earlier, that's not a relevant consideration for the trial court. But the purpose of the law, we have to look at how the legislature sought to achieve that purpose. The legislature did not change the standard of medical parole. That standard was in the old medical parole statute. What the legislature did with the compassionate release statute was open up eligibility to a larger class of inmates by removing the restriction on the crime of conviction and by moving operation of the issue out of the, you know, I'll call it administrative quagmire of parole and DOC and moving it to a superior court, where the inmate's given an attorney, the prosecutor has the right to be heard as well, and it proceeds in a more familiar setting. Third, Justice Patterson, your hypothetical, you know, I think that's a really good example of why the trial court was correct in this case, in looking at those parole factors, because it's probably not right, I'll agree, to say that if we can conceive of some possible way the inmate can commit a crime, then they're not entitled to release. But by looking at the parole factors, we take into account the crime of conviction, the inmate's criminal history, what they've done in jail, what they their other crimes. So there is something that's tied there. There is a basis, and that's what the trial court did in this case. We talked about subsection H, which talks about the release plan.
But what part of the statute ties in all of those parole factors?
Well, I think what the trial court found was this is essentially a parole decision. The person is being released, under parole, in a sense. And by looking at the threat to public safety, the trial court found most illustrative those factors. So
the reason I ask is the language in F1 directs us to subsection H, which puts forth relatively not particularly restrictive conditions here. Have a sponsor, have medical services, have housing. It's not a fuller array than that. What do you read from that?
Well, with subsection H, I think subsection H talks about exactly what happens once an inmate is granted compassionate release, not necessarily what happens at the hearing. So certainly the burden is on the inmate at the hearing to satisfy the trial court that there are conditions of release that will protect the public.
Let me ask this more specifically.
All right.
I heard you say that the determination of a threat to public safety turns on a host of conditions that parole might impose. And I'm asking you where that comes from under the statute, because the statute at F1, which goes back to the decision itself, only says consider the conditions of H. You follow me?
I do. I think those conditions are relevant, but the problem with those conditions is they don't take into account they don't do a holistic assessment.
Precisely.
Of the inmate.
It's a pretty low bar as drafted in F1. Sounds like you're elevating it by referencing a host of other conditions as well, and I'm asking you the basis for doing so, not whether it makes sense, but whether that's what the statute called for.
Certainly the statute doesn't cross-reference the parole factors, but I think what the trial court was thinking and what the state agrees with is that to determine whether someone is permanently incapable of committing a crime and determining whether they're a threat to public safety, one has to look at that person's history.
Is there any significance to the term release plan? And I have not looked, frankly, at the parole, because I didn't anticipate this issue, but the parole statute generally, does release plan have a meaning to it that imports the parole statute's general conditions?
I'm not sure if I'm understanding Your Honor's question correctly. I think what the conditions of release might be.
What I'm asking is whether the term release plan in this statute might, sometimes you find that a term has a definition and another subsection of the statute might provide some meaning to this. And this is a parole statute, as I understand it, right? It's under the parole law. So does release plan perhaps have some content to it that would allow conditions beyond the three that are mentioned in subsection
I don't know that it's specifically defined in the parole statute.
I don't know the answer to that either.
A definition, but certainly, under operation of this statute, the burden would be on the inmate to show that there are conditions of release that would prohibit, risk to public safety. To respond to Your Honor's hypothetical, such a person, if they were able to be released, I would submit, would not be allowed to use a phone. They would not be allowed to engage in that kind of communication if that is, quote unquote, their weapon of choice. Conditions like that, maybe they shouldn't be around children. Depending on the facts, there's so many different variations here. But certainly the burden, and this is another reason why FED in particular fails, is he came forward with nothing in terms of a post-release plan. He's going to live with his wife, who testified that she has really no idea what his medical needs even are. She testified that she knew he needed a cardiologist because he told her that. So she's not even aware of, you know, what she's taking on, in a sense. So I think it's important to recognize that the inmate has to basically lay out a very detailed plan. Like I said, if it's someone who needs 24-hour care in several different areas, they'd have to come forward and say, there's room at this particular place, they're willing to accept him, his needs will be treated there. Because what we can't do, and would be the antithesis of compassion, is to merely cut these inmates loose with no services, and nothing to protect them.
Can a family member care for someone 24 hours? Can a wife do so, as in this case?
It would depend on what the medical needs are. You know, if you take the ABDL of being able to feed yourself, certainly someone who lives with you 24 hours could say, I'm perfectly willing to do that, and that would be, you know.
You can bathe, clothe, ambulate him in a wheelchair, all those things, correct?
She could, of course, if that was her testimony and those were what his needs were.
If the legislature intended to have parole conditions beyond those three that might be imposed in a normal parole standard, I'm not asking you, I know you don't have the statute in front of you, but what would be conditions that would directly address the question of public safety in this case?
In this particular case?
In a case like such as this.
I mean, at a minimum, we would be asking for, you know, for house arrest, you know, short of going to medical appointments. Maybe they not be allowed to contact certain people. You know, we'd have to get more the trial record and see the witnesses and if they're still alive and what, you know, who was threatened. You know, there were credible threats in this case at the time of trial on witnesses. Judge Boehm, who was sitting as a trial judge at the time, found that. That is in the record. So that was a concern then. So those would be a couple of the conditions.
Do you agree with the Attorney General's paradigm and the Attorney General's brief? Is there any light between your position and the Attorney General?
Not really. I mean, I think what they're saying is a person can't perform an activity of basic daily living if they need 24-hour care to perform that activity. I think that's a reasonable reading of the statute. Anything else would, you know, the person would need 24-hour care. If they have an ABDL and they don't get 24-hour care, they're probably not going to survive very long. So I think that's a reasonable interpretation, you know, to impose going forward. But even under this statute, in this case, what the record lacks is any evidence that FED suffers two or three ABDLs to that level.
And you also agree that when looking at whether or not the inmate is likely to reoffend, we look at the inmate's prior criminal history, the crimes attendant as?
Of course, as well as his rehabilitative efforts. You know, that's exactly what the trial judge did here. The trial judge went through, using the parole factors, page after page, you know, weighing what he said at the time of the pre-sentence report, the facts of the crime, what he did.
Yeah, I missed that, because at least given this defendant's criminal history, he wasn't phoning in his crimes, correct?
No, not on the facts that we know.
So that would not be one of the concerns in a case like this.
But he was orchestrating potential threats on witnesses while incarcerated pretrial. So I'm not sure if he was doing that, you know, by letter or word of mouth or over the prison phone. But, you know, his criminal behavior went beyond the murder.
You would not take the position that he had to previously phone in a murder in order to be a threat in the future, given his history.
No, I don't think it has to be that rigid. I mean, but I would suggest what, you know, courts should do what the court did in this case, was look at the entirety of the man that was FED, both at the time of the crimes and today. And, you know, judges do this all the time. They do it every day in pretrial detention decisions. They look at what the person's charged with, they look at their criminal history, and they make a judgment call. Is this person going to be a threat if released? And as long as they look at the right information, they don't ignore critical information, then appellate courts defer to that decision. I do want to address something I think I might be uniquely able to address, and that was the question of the notice and the victim input. So what happened in this case, initially, the petition was filed in Union County. FED murdered a Hillside police officer. That was a Union County sentence. The issue that was then, he had already served that part of the sentence, and now he was serving the Essex sentences. So the compassionate release petition got transferred from Union County and their prosecutor's office to Essex County and our prosecutor's office. We made attempts to contact the victim. The AP who tried this case actually is still with our office. He was unable to locate them. Our victim witness unit, which, you know, in my opinion, best in the state, was unable to locate these victims and their families this far after the crimes. So that was done, but unfortunately, you know, we've had other cases, compassionate release cases, where, you know, those victims did appear. They came in, they testified virtually. So, you know, that is something we do. We just were not able to do in this particular case.
If you agree with the Attorney General's paradigm, then you also agree that the Appellate Division erred in its paradigm.
To the extent the Appellate Division says the inmate has to prove that he's unable to perform every single ABDL, yes, I think that might be, that's too strict of a standard. As I said, if someone can't do six of them but can somehow do a seventh, and I'm not even sure such a person would exist, but hypothetically, you know, that person would probably be entitled to release, assuming they meet all the other criteria.
Okay, so if we were to set a standard different from the Appellate Division and also decide that the defendant's name should be released, and given the fact that a year will have passed since the trial hearing, would it make sense for there to be a remand?
No, there's no need for a remand in this case because he was unable to show even one and certainly not two. What I think is important to keep in mind, though, is this is not a situation where he's forever prohibited from seeking compassionate release. He can apply any time his condition worsens to the point where he meets the criteria under the statute. He can't be denied release later because he was denied release this time. So affirming the judgment in this case would not prejudice his ability to seek compassionate release later, because at this point, you know, the record is would not satisfy, you know, any proposed standard here today. The court has no other questions. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Duco.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I understand the court has several questions about the DOC's process under the current new law. I think I can shed light on that, as well as on how the physicians communicate their medical conclusions under the law. But I did want to quickly address a few observations on the state of the, you know, parties' positions on the Appellate Division's substantive holdings and answer any questions the court may have on that first. So I think what's clear from all the advocates' positions today is agreement on what the legislature intended when it enacted the new law, which is to create more opportunities for the state's sickest inmates to serve out their remaining time outside of prison walls. And I think it's telling that no advocate before you is aligning with the Appellate Division's opinion on what substantively the inmate has to show to qualify for release under the statute. And so that's why the Attorney General asks this court to correct the legal ruling so that trial courts do have the proper guidance going forward. So very quickly, all advocates agree that the opinion erred in holding that the qualifying diagnosis of permanent physical incapacity requires the inmate to be unable to perform all activities of basic daily living, even with assistance. Instead, the law only requires that an inmate has to be unable to perform multiple, that is, two or more activities, and that must also result in the inmate requiring 24-hour care. That latter limitation means that only the most medically vulnerable inmates are eligible for release, but it doesn't mean that only the vanishingly few would qualify. Second, the opinion also incorrectly suggested that the requirement that the inmate be physically incapable of committing a crime be read literally. That, again, is not what the legislature intended, because it would mean, once again, that only the comatose individual would be released. The only logical purpose of the provision is to ensure that an inmate has shown he will not recidivate, that is, to commit the crimes that he had any previous propensity to commit in the first place. That's the only reading that both carries out the legislative intent and, perhaps more importantly, would not render all the other provisions, such as the public safety prong and all the definitions of permanent physical incapacity, completely superfluous. So the Attorney General urges this court to clarify those statutory requirements. We don't take a position on the specific medical record in this case or the petitioner's ultimate eligibility for release.
Let me ask you, I'm sorry, Chief. Please go ahead. Let me ask you about your second point with respect to the identity of the crime, just hypothetically, not this case. Someone is serving a long sentence for multiple burglaries and has made statements in the course of their time incarcerated that suggest that there are certain witnesses whom they would like to do away with as a result of their having been in jail based on the testimony of those witnesses. Now, that's not the crime for which that person is serving time. If, in fact, if the person applies for compassionate relief, release, can the trial court consider that there is a risk of a more serious crime than any of the individual crimes for which that individual was serving time? Or is the trial court's determination limited to, will there be more burglaries?
I don't think it's limited to the burglaries, Your Honor. I think in that situation, though, it's, remember, it's the defendant would have to be physically incapable of committing the crime, right, or the crime that we're talking about here. So if he's unable to commit burglaries just because he has threatened to commit other crimes such as murder, I presume that he would also be relatively physically unable to commit murder as well. So the
fact that let me add to the hypothetical. He knows people on the outside who are willing to help him out with that.
If there's a credible threat in his criminal history that he has a propensity to order hits without, and that, you know, physically still, the physical capacity for doing that still exists, I think that would be something that the trial court would be considering under that prong, yes.
So I want you to take an additional step and tell us how narrowly to look at the notion of recidivating, because hypothetically someone who had committed a murder for hire picked up a phone and arranged a killing and serving time, one could present a compelling argument that they wouldn't physically go out and hurt someone, put aside their capacity question right now. But is the same necessarily true in reverse?
In reverse, Your Honor, do you mean that they would...
Someone convicted of committing murder with their own hands, by their own hands, would a murder for hire, picking up a phone, be attendant to that crime, to use the phrase you put in your brief?
Your Honor, I think having that hypothetical without any actual criminal history that ties that propensity makes it very difficult to see how anyone would be released, because almost anybody would have the ability to pick up the phone to ask someone else to commit the crime, the physical crime that they were incarcerated for. So I think that would be, as a general standard, too broad. But I do think that in terms of how to evaluate someone whose crime of conviction or whose criminal history included these conspiracy offenses is to think about both whether or not they have the capacity to commit the actual crime, and also not just whether or not they have the capacity to pick up a phone, but whether they have the physical capacity that they previously had to orchestrate whatever is necessary for the crime to take place. Because you can make a lot of phone calls on the phone book, but you're not going to get the hitman unless you have other physical capacity to do things in the world to get there. And it could be that an individual in prison has the ability to do that as well. And so that's just something that the trial court would be considering in that circumstance. Of course, that's not necessarily, I don't think, the record before us, and it's not an issue that's been addressed by the appellate division. All that's been addressed is just, in general, what would have to be demonstrated to overcome the crime incapacity requirement. And you know, I think everyone agrees that a literal reading of that requirement in the abstract sense would not be in would not be congruous with what the legislature intended and would, in fact, render the entire statute and all its other provisions duplicative.
Should there be some standard linked to reasonableness, such as it would be substantially unlikely? Like what terminology do you suggest we should be using?
I think the terminology is already in the statute. So I think there's no requirement that the court has to find 100% chance that the person has no physical capacity to commit whatever crime it is. But rather, there has to be clear and convincing evidence that they lack the physical capacity to commit that specific crime or that set of crimes. So I think the statute itself already has the standard built in. I don't think the court needs to read in an additional standard.
Other states have done so, but New Jersey did not add the thoughtful suggestion of making it a reasonableness standard.
Yes, Your Honor, but the California statute that has the reasonableness requirement in it also doesn't have the clear and convincing evidence standard. So it's difficult to see whether or not those two things are truly apples to apples in terms of reading in that requirement. I do think that the clear and convincing evidence standard is the language that the legislature chose, and to then impose another layer of uncertainty is probably not what the legislature intended. So that's the standard we would propose that the court uses.
Do you read that language to mean that the legislature intended, with respect to the proof, to depart from the examples of other states to a substantial degree and impose a greater burden than other states do on inmates?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. It's hard to say whether the legislature was specifically looking at the California statute or other state statutes. That's not reflected in the legislative history. So I'd be loath to, you know, guess as to whether or not that intention is the intention was to depart. But I do know that from the language it did choose, and it's a very specific standard, clear and convincing means something to all of us in the law, that is the standard by which the trial court is instructed to operate.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between the standard of proof, like clear and convincing, and the underlying substantive standard. I'm just thinking about tort law, right? You have by a preponderance of the evidence, and then you have clear and convincing evidence standards, and then you have superimposed as a substantive standard. Due care, whether or not someone exercised reasonable care, by preponderance of the evidence, by clear and convincing evidence. So I'm not so certain merely saying by clear and convincing evidence somehow is defining the substantive standard. Do you follow me?
I do understand, Your Honor. So there is no substantive standard that's under that the legislature chose to impose, for example, on the crime incapacity requirement. And all I can say is that I think what that requires is that the evidence is so strong that the court has no doubt as to the crime incapacity or the physical incapacity to commit a crime. I do think it is persuasive authority.
Now you just added something. It has no doubt. And you're substituting that for reasonableness or substantially unlikely. You've just imposed your own there, yes?
I do catch that, Your Honor. I think
you got that from the word convincing, perhaps?
I think it is difficult to talk about it without adding something in there, and I think Your Honor's onto something. That's, again, not an issue specifically presented here. I will say that it is persuasive that the California decisions, the Martinez decision that we cite, which itself cites to a prior version of its own, a prior iteration in that proceeding, where it noted that the prior California medical parole statute did not include the word reasonable. The court then held it could not read the word reasonable into it. Then the legislature changed the statute to add the word reasonable, and then therefore the later Martinez decision held that that is the standard by which they operate. And so without that here, it is certainly not binding on this court. The court does not have to follow.
We may have to interpret, because the word absolutely isn't there. Would not absolutely pose a threat.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The word like absolutely isn't before would not pose a threat. We don't know in terms of clearing.
That's true, Your Honor.
So the question is like what degree, what degree of tolerance of risk is permissible within that clear and convincing standard? Is it absolute, substantially unlikely, reasonable? You were superimposing your own
Yes, Your Honor, but I think practically it kind of results in a similar result, because if I say, if the court finds that there's clear and convincing evidence that I am not going to leave this court and steal a car, I think the court is, you know, has a certain level of certainty in mind when it makes that statement, even without saying there's no clear and convincing evidence that I would not reasonably pose a risk of stealing a car.
It's clear and convincing evidence that the inmate would not pose a threat to public safety. So the court has to be convinced that there are conditions that would release with the conditions would not pose a threat to public safety.
Yes, Your Honor. So there's two different findings that the trial court has to make. First, for any inmate who has a qualifying medical diagnosis, be it a current terminal condition or permanent physical incapacity, that person has to be found incapable of committing a crime, which we submit to the court is recidivating. And only for those who qualify on the basis of permanent physical incapacity, but not for terminal patients, there would also be an additional standard that the conditions established by the state parole board that the inmate has submitted under a plan would not pose a threat to public safety. So there is an additional rule that subset of inmates would have to prove. And we submit to you that is, you know, an additional hurdle that the defendant would have to demonstrate. That is also by a clear and convincing evidence standard. And so that would be, once again, that wasn't squarely reached by the appellate division. And in this particular case, there are sort of process-based questions as to whether or not the state parole board actually did create those, or, you know, did verify those conditions, and whether or not the inmate, who's one of the first to apply for compassionate release, actually went ahead and submitted a plan with all those things. So that question is really not squarely before the court in the Attorney General's view, and we don't really take a position on what would be required in that instance. I will note that the AOC directive now makes it clear that the parole board should submit to the Superior Court the plan and its assessment, and that there is, you know, to let the court know if their assessment is forthcoming, so that the court knows what to do if it needs to wait a few days before the hearing or to come back to it afterwards. So that's already now outlined.
Is it the inmate's burden in the first instance to create the parole plan?
Of course, Your Honor, because the parole board can't be, you know, telling the inmate this is where you're going to live, this is how, you know, the care that we found for you. It's the inmate's responsibility to create that plan. And under subsection H, the parole board has to identify who that individual who's going to sponsor the individual and verify appropriate housing, medical care, and all that. That the inmate is not just, you know, making it up or, you know, doesn't actually have the ability to rely on something on the outside.
Do you read the term release plan in Section 8 to be broader than the three components identified?
Yes, because it says to ensure that the inmate's release plan includes these three things, but it can certainly include other things that could also assure the trial court that the inmate would not pose a threat to public safety. So it would be whatever the inmate has, at a minimum, would have to include those things, but it would almost certainly in many cases include other things, such as how you're going to leave, what your transportation is, you know, whatever that is, you know, if that's what the inmate wants to submit before the court.
You heard all this colloquy about agency deference. Do you want to weigh in on that subject?
Very much so, Your Honor. So a few observations off the top that I think will help clarify some of the procedural cobwebs, if you will. So this is one of the earliest cases under the new statute. And the path that it took to reach this court, I think, is unlikely to be repeated. And there's two reasons for that. The first is that the DOC's process now reflects the correct understanding of the statute, which is that it only allows the relevant qualifying diagnosis, be it terminal illness or permanent physical incapacity, to be made by the designated physicians who are for our DOC Rutgers doctors. So the DOC itself does not make a medical determination of eligibility. The statute does not provide for that type of DOC discretion and instead leaves that judgment entirely to the doctors. So Justice Albin, I think you are entirely correct, and I think Justice Patterson, you are also correct in observing some of those interplays there. But the statute itself is unmistakably clear. If you look through it and find where the DOC commissioner is given any responsibility, those are purely ministerial responsibilities. It does not give the DOC discretion. Second, the doctors evaluation of the inmate is now specifically keyed to the statutory requirements for qualifying diagnosis. So there's now a form that requires the doctor to select from literally a checkbox, yes or no, whether the inmate has a terminal illness or permanent physical incapacity. There's also another checkbox that they have to check off whether or not the inmate requires 24-hour care and is unable to carry out the activities of basic daily living. So if this court gives guidance on what the statutory definition of permanent physical incapacity is, that becomes the benchmark against which the doctors will be measuring their individual medical evidence. And that's now a process that doesn't really require the DOC to exercise any discretion. The doctors will literally check off yes or no. Of course, if there's, you know, if something doesn't get checked off, you know, they can do the administrative process of making sure that that happens, but there is no substantive review role for the DOC. So I do think that overall, you know, there may be additional questions you want to come back to, but I think that may answer some of the questions you had previously.
Where does that take you on the question of the appropriate standard of review?
So I think the standard of review, so it's two things. One is the certificate of eligibility itself is just the gateway to take medical diagnoses into the jurisdictional document that opens the courthouse doors for someone who qualifies. So it doesn't really, you know, there's no reason for a court to be unless there's some other special circumstance, to be evaluating was that certificate validly issued or not. If the person is before you in court, you're evaluating the person whether or not they meet the statutory definitions for release, not whether or not the agency appropriately issued the certificate or not. I understand that the Criminal Justice Commission had written something about that, but the Criminal Justice Commission is not setting up the whole statutory framework and the statutory processes. And so that statement doesn't really mean anything in the context of the full statute itself. We're looking to the Criminal Commission's substantive recommendations because that's what the legislature relied on, but obviously the legislature set up its own administrative process for how this works. So that's the standard of review, so to speak, on the certificate of eligibility. On the substantive decisions or medical evaluations that the doctors made, that's not a final agency determination. These doctors are just making their medical diagnoses. So I think the deference that a trial court would make is not really in the line of arbitrary and capricious. That doesn't really make sense for a court to be evaluating whether a medical doctor was arbitrarily and capriciously determining something, but rather, you know, the deference that one would give as a trial court to any medical expert. You know, their opinion is this. This is the basis of their opinion that they've stated in their medical records. And so just like, you know, in a tort case, when there's an accident and a doctor opines on whether or not the patient has, you know, 10 years left to live or not, that's also the kind of deference the court will be giving to those medical doctors in this case.
Now, the court, in a tort case, where the court happens to be the fact finder, can disregard a medical expert's opinion in its entirety. Is that also true here?
No, Your Honor, because the legislature specifically intended for the medical doctors' evaluations to carry some weight, right? And so that's already baked in. Now, there was a previous question as to can the state present its own medical experts. I think in this case, you know, it happened to be the defendant who wanted to present, you know, additional medical testimony, and the court allowed that. I think under special circumstances, you could. I will make two observations, though. The first is that I think it's very difficult to overcome the judgments. Remember, they have to be both doctors that the DOC designated, who are just Rutgers doctors who care for the patients at DOC, have to reach agreement on what the qualifying diagnosis is. So I think only under very special circumstances would an outside physician hired by the state would somehow be able to overturn that consensus of the two doctors who are doing this, you know, on a regular basis. I suppose, though, it is possible, right? So you could have an individual who gets a qualifying diagnosis and, you know, he walks into court for the hearing and they're totally fine and doesn't have any of the incapacities that's reported.
Well, there could be, but then the other question is whether or not the inmate is so debilitated or incapacitated that the inmate is not capable of committing a crime, and that could be potentially the subject of debate.
Yes, Your Honor. So certainly, I think in any case, you would have, the court is free to, you know, accept the sort of delta between having a permanent physical incapacity or terminal illness and being so incapacitated to be unable to commit whatever crime it is we're talking about. So the medical expert would certainly play a role in that framework if they're, you know, offered and if the court accepts their testimony. But going back, you know, embedded in that question of whether or not you're so incapacitated is, are you incapacitated by these conditions at all? And if there's a question as to the legitimacy of that, I think it's very unusual that that would come up, because I think the doctors are, you know, the two doctors are not unlikely just to reach that conclusion without, you know, really, really heavy basis. But I guess it's just answering the technical question, it is possible that the court could make that evaluation on the basis of some doctors.
But when the trial court does go through the two prongs of the standard under subsection F, does an appellate court defer to the fact findings of that trial court?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's no different from any other standard in which the appellate division would be reviewing a clear and convincing finding by the trial court.
Your position that the certificate issued by the doctors, by the Department of Corrections, which triggers the jurisdiction of the trial court to determine the application, that the court has no authority to challenge jurisdiction, whether there is jurisdiction, that that automatically is unchallengeable.
So if there are two doctors who have rendered a qualifying diagnosis, so that's step one, then the DOC has no discretion to deny the certificate document that gives the inmate jurisdiction to petition. And so in that event, it's difficult to see how the court would be questioning the jurisdiction of its own jurisdiction in that case, because it says under the statute that under D2, in the event that the medical diagnosis determines an inmate is suffering from the qualifying condition, the Department of Corrections shall promptly issue the certificate. And then in subsection F2, it states that no petition may be submitted to the court unless it's accompanied by the certificate of eligibility.
You're going to make this bulletproof, because you're going to create a document with a bunch of checklists. So there's not going to be any question that the doctors, when they render their decision, are hitting the right qualifying features of the statute. Am I correct? And that's what you were sort of telling us.
Yeah, so that is the process that's currently in place. I hesitate to call anything bulletproof, because something could slip through the cracks, but you know, it's designed to carry out the statute in the specific way that the legislature has.
So it obligates the court to always get to the merits.
I think so, Your Honor. I think the question then, you know, once the petition is submitted to the court and it's gone through step one, the doctor's qualifying diagnosis, step two, the issuance of the certificate, which is, you know, relatively pro forma, then the court is presented with the actual petition.
The court hears the testimony, may hear the testimony of witnesses, looks at evidence, and makes fact findings as the first fact finder on the ultimate two issues in the statute. In other words, there's no prior fact-finding that needs to be deferred to or overturned or anything. The trial court is making those fact-findings.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
And they're subject to the normal deference that we give fact-finding.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe, this is just to make sure that we're all on the same page, in subsection E7, the statute does say that if there is no objection, then the court can make a determination on the petition without even holding the hearing. But that's, of course, you know, not this case.
The form that you referred to, is that in the record?
It is not in the record, Your Honor.
Submit a copy to counsel in the court?
We can, Your Honor, yes.
One of your earlier answers touched on life expectancy, which goes to a question that I had that is not part of this appeal, so you're welcome to decline to answer it. But I was wondering if you could help us understand Section L, the definition for grave medical condition and terminal condition. Both call for proof of life expectancy. In the first case, proof that the inmate has 6 to 12 months to live, and in the second case, 6 months or less. What type of proof is anticipated for that? Do doctors give that sort of certification? I'm not familiar with them doing so.
So, Your Honor, that is the same. It's different for grave medical condition in that the period of time is lessened, but that standard of 6 months less or less to live has existed in the medical parole statute for a very long time. I'm not aware of exactly whether the court has ever opined on what that means. As of now, you know, as with many of the embedded medical decisions that lead to that ultimate decision, that is left to the doctor to decide.
There's something similar, is there not, in the assisted suicide statutes, at least some states' assisted suicide statutes, that a the person is considered to be likely to have less than 6 months to live or something along those lines. I'm not sure about our states.
Yeah, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that, but that's possible. All I will say is that in that situation, in this situation, it's the physician who's determining, which I think, you know, is not an uncommon, you know, question that doctors are asked, how much longer does this person have left to live?
What's their usual answer?
That they're not.
I don't give that.
They're not certain. Sure.
They do it, but within a reasonable degree of medical probability. I mean,
yes. That's
the cushion.
Yes, Your Honor. And I can confirm that the form, as I remember it, does say to either to a reasonable degree of medical certainty or language very much like that, either diagnosis, either terminal illness or permanent physical incapacity. That's the standard by which the doctors are making their evaluations as well.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor.
No?
Yeah, no, Your Honor. So we will submit the form to you.
Thank you. Ms. Kim,
Very briefly, Your Honor. Honors, looking at the statute, I agree with the Attorney General that if the DOC physicians here determine that someone has a qualifying medical diagnosis, then the DOC has to issue that certificate of eligibility. And I think it's important to reiterate, as a lot of my other counsel have, that this is just the first step in obtaining compassionate release. It's just a way of getting before the trial court. And then the trial court's job is really to look at the relationship between the inmate's health and their risk to the public. And to answer Justice Patterson's question, I think that when the trial court is applying the appropriate definition of the law, then appellate courts are reviewing these cases under the typical abuse of discretion standard. In this case here, though, we had both the trial court and the appellate division misinterpreting the compassionate.
It wouldn't be abuse of discretion if it were deference to when we're looking at fact finding, we're looking to see if there's the fact findings of the trial court are supported by sufficient credible evidence in the record.
For the facts, yes, but I think the public safety analysis.
Really, you could have fact finding on both of these issues.
The facts, I guess the legal determination would be, if applying the correct definition of the law, the legal determination would be the abuse of discretion. The facts are entitled to deference. I agree with that, Your Honor. I think what's important in this case, though, is that the correct legal definition of permanent physical incapacity, of incapable of committing a crime, of the public safety analysis, those were never applied to the facts of FED's case. And I would argue that we have enough evidence in the record here for this court to apply the law to FED's case and find that he meets the criteria for compassionate release. But alternatively, I would ask this court to remand the case for evaluation of FED's petition under a proper interpretation of the law and to order that be done in an expedited manner due to the serious debilitating nature of his health. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for the helpful argument.